Come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Gang. Proudly sponsored by Victory Point Games. This time around, Elliot will be reviewing Ninja, Legend of the Scorpion Clan from AEG, and Bloodsuckers from Fireside Games. Jeff will be reviewing Sentinels of the Multiverse from Greater Than Games, and Hero of Weehawken from Victory Point Games. We'll have news, views, and more on this episode of The Gaming Gang. Now here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
Hello to the diabolically evil Elliot Miller. How's it going?
Not bad. Not bad at all. I went to Wizard World. Was that last weekend?
The Chicago Comic Con?
Yeah, the Chicago Comic Con.
That was last weekend.
So, I don't know, if you don't mind, I'd just like to take a minute to say that I was kind of disappointed in the new Wizard World Chicago Comic Con. I know we've gone in years past and, you know, they'd have all the comic publishers there and they'd be selling exclusives for the convention only where you could pick something up and then
turn around, sell it, make a big profit 2 days later. Yeah,
exactly.
I remember. Yeah,
and then they had those VIP passes you could get where you get a whole big bag of goodies and stuff.
Mm-hmm. More exclusive things that other people couldn't get without the $150 ticket or whatever. Yeah, I remember.
And there were no publishers there at all. Well, okay, I'm lying. There was, I think I saw a Top Cow there.
Stop lying.
And there may have been one or two really small ones, but most of them didn't show up. So there was no like little fun booths to do stuff at. It consisted, half of it was just retailers selling old comic books.
Mm-hmm.
The other half was stars there selling autographs.
And then the third half was
was Artist Alley.
Yeah.
Which is huge now because none of the artists are actually in booths. They're just sitting at these tables now.
Right.
But, you know, it was much easier to bring a comic to a certain publisher and then the artist was sitting right there. And now it's just completely different. Even if you go to the Wizard World website, all their pictures of how great the Comic-Con was pictures of people who came there in costume.
Yeah.
It wasn't pictures of things that were going on.
Right.
You know, and they said, oh, Family Day was great. Family Day wasn't great. Family Day was miserable. There's nothing for the kids to do there. You paid $35 to get your face painted. The multitude of stars that they had there. Where you'd get to sit for an hour and a bunch of fans would get up and ask questions. And, you know, some were better than others. The guys from Torchwood were really funny.
I have a question here. Yeah, go ahead. I was just kind of curious. How come Chicago Comic Con sucks?
I'm telling you, I was pretty disappointed. It's not like Comic Cons of old.
My brother collects comics, which is funny because I got him back into collecting comics and then I dropped back out of the hobby.
Right.
But he enjoys going and filling slots up in his collection that he needs, especially Spider-Man comic books and things like that. So he had a pretty good time. But I know exactly where you're coming from, because when we went a few years in a row, and it was Wizard World. It wasn't the Chicago Comic Con.
Right.
They were two separate entities. In fact, when we went, they didn't even have the Chicago Comic Con. That was something that was fairly new. We used to go and you had Marvel and DC and you had different game companies that were there. Now, I know that there was an announcement not too long ago, a month back, saying that Gamma had signed an agreement with Wizard World and they were going to have a presence at the various different comic book conventions. So you went there thinking, oh, hey, cool. We're going to see kind of a gaming presence there too.
Yeah.
And that was a waste of time as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. You know, I think they just didn't have enough time to get something together for Comic-Con because it was only a couple weeks after the announcement. Because they had one long table where there was a bunch of games that you could check out and sit at one of the half dozen other tables
and play.
Mm-hmm. And that was about it. There was one guy there demonstrating this game, Chaosel, which looked really neat. And I don't, I didn't get a chance to play it, but it looked really neat, and I took a
because you were so busy with everything else going.
Right. Well, he was always doing a demo, you know, right in the middle of a demo. This guy was nonstop. So I stood for a while and watched it. It's all 3D, you know, it's got all the walls, and they're all nicely molded and things like that. I don't know anything really about the game, but looked interesting. Other than that, I didn't see game companies there at all. I remember in the past going there, and Wizards of the Coast was there, and they had their big wheel or the giant 20-sided die that you could roll
right
to win stuff, and none of that was going on. So, eh.
That's what it all boils down to. You're just upset that you didn't get any free goodies.
Hey, most places at least give you some kind of swag.
Well, that's too bad. It's too bad to hear that the Chicago Comic Con just wasn't up to your specifications for enjoyment.
Exactly. Specification for enjoyment, number X21.
Fail. Check it off your list. Myself, just been busy. Just busy, busy, busy.
Busy, busy, busy.
That's right. Just had so much to do. Yeah, it just, you know, settling back in from Gen Con, getting all those extras up. I hope everybody out there really got a kick out of all the different interviews that we did. And we are looking forward to next year visiting Gen Con. That should be a lot of fun again. I believe I just saw that they had signed a 5-year contract that they are going to still remain in Indianapolis.
Are we ready for some news?
I believe so.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South American. All the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to France. Flash.
Dominion Hinterlands this October. Yes, Rio Grande Games has announced the next expansion for the original deck-building game Dominion. Dominion Hinterlands. The description, now there's not a lot of stuff out about this expansion really at all.
It's Rio Grande. They never release a whole lot of information on anything.
The description is humorous. And it does not provide much info. What I do know is that the new expansion will add 26 new kingdom cards, including 20 actions, 3 treasures, 3 victory cards, and 3 reactions. The central theme is cards that do something immediately when you buy them or you gain them.
Like they massage your neck?
Right. Oh, this is great. I love it. And now it pleases me to be able to provide the rest of the description as written by designer Donald Vaccarino. The world is big. And your kingdom small. Small when compared to the world, that is. It's moderate size when compared to other kingdoms, but in a big world like this one, big when compared to smaller worlds anyway, if such things exist, it's moderate size when compared to worlds of roughly the same size and a little small when compared to worlds just a little larger. Well, to make a long story short when compared to longer stories anyway, it's time to stretch your borders. You've heard of far-off places, exotic countries, where they have pancakes but not waffles, where the people wear the wrong number of shirts and don't even have a word for the look two people give each other when they each hope that the other will do something that they both want done, but which neither of them wants to do.
Or the look that people give each other when they say, another Dominion expansion?
It is to these lands that you now turn your gaze. So, there you go. The description right from the designer's mouth.
But you said it was humorous.
You'll either love it or hate it. But it tells you
enough. The only person who was laughing at that is the guy who wrote it.
That's it.
That's it.
That's the description.
Makes me want to run out and buy it now.
I've already pre-ordered.
I don't know. Sounds like the designer has some sort of size fixation. AEG has partnered with Zebu Studio to bring their best-selling Thunderstone franchise to Facebook, iOS, and the Android platforms. Thunderstone Online will offer a custom-designed campaign mode where the player will start as a humble villager, then battle his way through different challenges to unlock more and more village cards. There's also going to be a single-player skirmish mode where the player can battle the AI with all the cards at his disposal. Multiplayer mode will also be offered, both online synchronous and asynchronous. The base offering is going to be free to play, and players can pay for additional expansion packs, which will include new cards and campaigns. In other Thunderstone news, as we already learned from Todd Rowland in our TGG Extra, Heart of Doom is going to be the latest expansion for Thunderstone, and it's going to be available in October. Previews of the release are going to begin appearing on the AEG website next month. Also in October is Blood Country, the latest expansion for Nightfall.
That's their hillbilly expansion, right?
It is their hillbilly expansion, yes. That is correct.
What in the hell?
You'll have cards for people who believe in intelligent design fighting the vampires and things like that.
How can these things exist?
Yeah?
Gotta be part of the plan.
That's right.
Maybe I should let them eat me.
Have you seen the people that the GOP are running up there?
I haven't paid much attention yet, no.
Let's just say that the individuals that they've got, somehow they don't know the Age of Enlightenment took place.
There was this thing called the Renaissance.
That's rare. Yeah, I know all about that. Come on, I've been to that fair. Unbelievable. Anyway, stepping away from politics, you're up.
Commander-in-Chief. X Plus Products has released Commander-in-Chief. It's an abstract strategy war game that's played on a checkerboard with various military pieces. The pieces consist of land, air, and sea units that allow you to fly over with the aircraft or move under with the submarine other pieces. The pieces can be enhanced during gameplay to give more opportunity for a losing player to come from behind. The game comes with a nice set of pieces that would easily become excellent toys for kids of all ages. The game itself can be played as intended or as chess or checkers. There's also options for up to four players, and the list price is suggested at $39.99.
What? $39.99?
The pieces look nice.
A variation of checkers?
Yes. But hey, the...
Did you dig this up? Did somebody email you this? Somebody had to have emailed
No, me. I found it on Fun Again Games. New release. Brand new. And hey, I'm not saying I'm going to go out and run out and pick it up for $40, but hey, listen, the bases
$40
can combine so that you can use them as little tops that spin, and you can play many different family games with spinning tops. That's what it says.
I'm going to have to, when we're done with the show, I am going to have to take a look at this website just to find out who has the audacity to sit there and charge $40 for a checkerboard with some little plastic army figures.
That's what it is. X Plus Products.
X Plus! X, 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 minus, minus, minus. One. Okay. Well, seeing that we're on the topic of, I suppose, family games, but one that's not running $40 to pick up, partner up with A Keen and Clever Horse in Perfect Stride. A variety of challenges await in this exciting horse jumping race.
Whee!
You and up to three competitors play skilled riders. But be ready for the unexpected, because sometimes lucky events occur and sometimes trouble comes your way. Elliot knows all about that. Collect the most ribbons to win the game. Challenge your friends to a fun horse game packed with adventure and strategy. This unique game appeals to both children and adults and includes a beautifully illustrated 95-card deck, 54 ribbon cards, 16 pace cards, a rule book, and a lead rider token. Nice thing about this is if you scramble over to perfectstride.net before August 25th, you'll be able to score the game for $10 instead of the MSRP of $24.95.
Holy cow.
But you only have a few days to do so. I have to point out, from what I've seen of the game, the artwork is really nice. I have seen some reviews floating around on some websites out there that appeal more to, you know, the family gamer and things like that. And they all are just raving about this game.
Huh.
So it's Perfect Stride, and yes, it's a horse race, but it's not the kind where you're standing next to some guy chomping on a cigar, hacking a phlegm and spitting it into the trash can while you place your bets.
What is it, like a steeplechase?
Sort of, yes.
Huh. But they don't have tiny miniature aircraft or submarines?
No. And the horses, you can't jump over the other horses or go under them.
I'm going under.
I think it's the Board Game Family is one of the websites that did a review of it. They gave it like 5 out of 5.
Really?
Yeah. So for the family gamers out there, since I never talk about family games, I'm throwing a big save some dough on this game and check it out.
Nice.
Perfect Stride at perfectstride.net. Come on, man. I got you the trifecta. Let's go.
Go, you bastard.
Damn it, Janie. I told you not to play that card. What's wrong with you? I know you're 5 and can't read the text, but I don't care.
Coming Thursday, September 1st at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. GMT Games will host a live online demo for their game Infidel. Wait, how'd that go?
You may recall I did review that GMT.
Yes, you did.
It's on the website. Good game.
The demo requires you to have Ventrilo access and
you have to have a ventriloquist.
A ventriloquist.
Hello, Jeff. I'm going to play this game while I drink this glass of water.
My goodness, I didn't even see Elliot's lips move.
Plus a specific vassal module loaded in order to participate.
Do you have to have that dummy? Remember that movie Magic with, like, I think it was Anthony Hopkins, where he has that ventriloquist dummy that possesses him and he's crazy? Well, you said you have to have a ventriloquist.
Ventrilo access.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
There you go. Luckily, GMT provides free use of their Ventrilo voice server to all of their customers. And you can figure out how to get there by checking our website. This is the second volume in the Iron Man series. Infidel focuses on the major battles of the early Crusades era between Christians and the Muslims. This is a period that saw cavalry reign supreme and pitted European mounted armored men-at-arms, which relied on furious and direct charges with sword and lance, against the Eastern European Turkish light cavalry tactics, focusing on the efficiency of its mounted archers. Infidel is designed for quick learning and easy play, and game rules are short. There's no turns. Play is continual, with ample opportunities to steal play from your opponent, the Infidels. And combat resolution is a single die roll. Takes about 1 or 2 hours per battle. That's just a brief description. I know you know about it.
You're preaching to the choir here.
But for those who haven't had a chance to check it out, they have their chance Thursday, September 1st at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Check it out. Speaking of GMT, they've released a slew of new titles over the past few weeks. I know a lot of people were kind of concerned because there hadn't been a lot coming out from GMT this year. There's 4 titles I can pull right off the top of my head. There's Son of York, and that's S-U-N of York, Space Empires 4X, Sekigahara, and No Retreat.
Sekijuia.
No, that's a sequel. Uh-huh. Now, Son of York is a 2-player card game, and that deals with the battles of the War of the Roses that took place in England. Space Empires 4X is, as you guessed, a science fiction empire-building game. Sekigahara is a 2-player block-based Fog of War game that tackles the 17th century struggle for unification of Japan. And No Retreat is the GMT Deluxe treatment of the Victory Point Games release, along with the 2 expansions. And that's the Russian front during World War II. So there are lots of goodies out there from GMT, and there's plenty to appeal to different gamers of all stripes.
Very nice. I am really looking forward to getting a chance playing Space Empires 4X.
That's right up your alley. Mm-hmm.
It has space in the title, so.
I mean, it's 4 times
that. 4 times the fun.
Well, we'll have reviews of all 4 of those titles in the near future.
For those like me who have never played, gasp, Twilight Imperium, thank you, because it has gotten pretty scarce on store shelves, there is some good news. Fantasy Flight Games is expecting the reprint of Twilight Imperium 3rd Edition to land on the U.S. shores in September. Now, this is one of those games that everyone talks about. There's rumors of epic games lasting 8 hours or more, which take me back to my early days of gaming, where we would play an RPG or a war game that would just be a titanic adventure. Of course, we didn't have much in the way of video games or the internet back then, so it didn't make much difference. We didn't have anything else to do.
No, not really. Text message? Yeah. Text message was, I'll write something on a piece of paper and hand
there
it to
you. There you go. Twilight Imperium was the first game FFG ever published and has gone through 2 evolutions since its initial release, which is why it's, of course, 3rd edition. along with the Shattered Empire expansion and the recently released Shards of the Throne expansion. For those of you unfamiliar with Twilight Imperium, here's a little background info. Twilight Imperium is an epic board game of galactic conquest for 3 to 6 players. Taking on the role of one of 10 ancient civilizations, players compete for interstellar supremacy through warfare, trade, uncertain allegiances, and political dominance. Each civilization provides a unique game experience with different abilities and playstyles. Will you play as the Emirates of Hakan and preside over every trade agreement made in the galaxy? Well, or will you be the Federation of Sol and rapidly take over worlds in hopes of dominating the entire galaxy? In Twilight Imperium, many roads lead to Rome, or Mechatol Rex.
I have heard that some of those games of Twilight Imperium can be so long that people have conceived and delivered children during a game.
Now that's a long game. And they named them after, of course, various characters in the game.
Well, we're on the topic of Twilight Imperium. When we were at Gen Con, Fantasy Flight Games announced Rex, The Decline of an Empire, I believe, is the subtitle to it. And we saw some of the components, which we have a photo of on the website. And we thought it was just a space conflict game because the pieces we saw were obviously like starships and things like that. It turns out that it is actually a reworking of Avalon Hill's Dune. And I understand that Fantasy Flight Games couldn't get the rights to reprint Dune. So they did the next best thing. They're actually going to rework the mechanics of the game. And they're setting it in the Twilight Imperium background. You know, that backdrop, that backstory. Yeah. So a lot of people are pretty excited about that. I've noticed that Fantasy Flight is really pumping up the reprints of some of their titles that have been out of print and going for pretty big bucks on the secondary market.
Yeah, I noticed that too. Just in the past couple of days, they've announced a bunch of reprints of different things. Like the Game of Thrones LCG, the original expansions for that.
The board game, doing a second edition of Descent. So that's another one that's coming out. So I guess what Fantasy Flight Games, I guess their thought process is, if these titles are going for big bucks on the secondary market, why not reprint them and make that money themselves?
Well, it makes sense, really.
Makes sense to me, too.
You know what? One more thing. Talked a lot about how FFG, they give you the box that's filled with air, and there's no good way to do storage when you pick up a lot of their games.
Right.
And I've complimented a lot of other companies. Well, I actually did some research and found out that this was an actual business decision by them, because a lot of people take the inserts that come with their games and just toss them out immediately. And
right.
Either they pick up a Plano box if there's enough different types of counters and stuff and fill that up and keep that separate. Or since FFG has all these expansions that they do, they just
put them in the box.
Exactly. And so their solution was to just really not do anything, because some people will like it and some people don't. And they can't keep everybody happy.
A lot of people enjoy making their own tuck boxes for games.
Yeah.
So I know that's out there too. I'm more along the lines of yourself, though, that I like to have that option where if I wanted to pull that insert and throw it away, I'd like to be able to do that. If not, I'd like to be able to sort the different pieces.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you know what? I would even go so far as to say, if they sold just a separate storage solution for a couple of their games, Arkham Horror comes to mind, or Descent. You know, so rather than increasing the cost of the base game, you can purchase, if you so desire, your own little separate storage solution that's got all the nice graphics for that game all over the outside of it. And you can open it up and put all your stuff in there.
Would you honestly buy something like that? I mean, pay for shipping and everything else?
Yeah, I would. I mean, people, they sell sleeves. I mean, it's FFG. They're selling sleeves now for cards, and they're selling other
what do you
stuff.
Mean? They sell shirts? They got shirts? What are you talking about?
You know, card sleeves. If there was something out there, I've seen on The Geek people selling different storage solutions for certain games for a lot of cash. You know, I'd like there to be some kind of, for certain games, you know, not every game. Yeah, maybe that's just me.
Hey, maybe that's a business we can go into.
There you go. Storage boxes for games. I don't understand how people can just take parts of their games and throw it away. I don't care about a little plastic thing, but
yeah, a lot of people throw away the box for their expansions.
Yeah, and put it all in one box. I could never do that. That would be sacrilegious to me.
I guess. I don't know. I've never done it. Sometimes I sit here and I think to myself, my gosh, thank God I'm moving again soon because I certainly need more room.
Yeah, but I mean, I could see if you really need to be portable, you're going to a game night somewhere and you want to take a couple games with you. Well, you load up one of your special storage boxes and poof, off you go.
There you
go.
But
you still have your boxes at home. I don't know.
No, I understand. And two last pieces of news, and they have to do with us.
Nice. We're the coolest.
There you go. First off, our contest to score a free copy of Dragon Face is coming to an end. Everybody out there, it's pretty easy to enter. All you have to do is visit the website, and you can either like us on Facebook, you can comment on the website itself, or you can write a review on iTunes for the podcast. So there's three separate copies that we're giving away, so there's three different ways for you to win. That is going to come to an end at the end of the month. And the second item was we are going to celebrate our one-year anniversary next month. We're kind of being tricky here because we are going to have a big contest with multiple different games that are available to be won. It's going to be a winner-take-all scavenger hunt across the internet. We're going to make it where it's not too much work to be able to enter, but it's simply not just emailing us your name. So far, we've got quite a few different companies who are going to be donating games to the contest. We've got AEG, we've got North Star Games, Victory Point Games, and we've reached out to just about every company that we work with. We're just kind of bouncing around some of the details. So we should probably have copies of 10 different games that one lucky winner will score. So September 1st, we'll have that up on the website. So be sure to swing on by and jump into the scavenger hunt.
You know, one thing I have to say about Dragon Face is, to me, it's like a game that you would have, say, on a coffee table. Like people put their fancy chessboards and stuff. It's kind of a fancy game because it's got these really nice pieces and a nice cloth board that folds out like a scroll. And these nice, I mean, they feel like they're porcelain or something. Pieces that are reversible, so you know, you travel across the board, you flip it over and it becomes the other person's token, that kind of thing.
But the question I have is, can you go over or under the other players?
Only pieces? If you have the special aircraft or submarine dragons.
Is that game a $40 game?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I'm just curious. I'm just wondering because I didn't know if they had the audacity to charge $40 for a checkers / chess spinning top game.
The spinning top is what sells it, I'm telling you.
That's it. You can play checkers, you can play chess, but you can't spin those pieces like a top now, can you? So shall we get on to the reviews?
I say so.
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
The first game I'm going to talk about is Ninja, Legend of the Scorpion Clan, from AEG. It was designed by Frederick Moyer. It was designed by Friedrich Moyersohn. It was designed by Friedrich Moyersohn. The game has not hit store shelves yet, but there were some advanced copies at Gen Con, so some people have gotten a chance to try it out.
Like it's us!
Yes. It's for 2 to 4 players, ages 12 and up. Game takes less than an hour to play. Ninja is the new board game from AEG that is set in their Legends of the Five Rings universe. It's a hidden movement game that's inside a Japanese compound. The intruder player or players are attempting to infiltrate the compound in order to complete a specific mission, and the other players are the guards attempting to stop the intruders. Now, the game ends when there's no intruders left on the board. They either are dead or they escaped, or after the 20th turn. The intruders win if they complete their mission and escape, but if only one escapes, it's a draw. any other outcome is basically a victory for the guards. Now, let me say, I think the components for this game are top-notch. The minis are really nicely done. Mm-hmm. The cards have excellent artwork, reminiscent to me of like the Nightfall style, albeit different subject matter entirely. The board is beautiful with an overhead view of an ornamentally landscaped compound with moats, bridges, houses, pathways, sentry posts. The game comes with four separate hidden movement pads, and each of those have 25 tear-off maps. They're fairly good size. They're about 7x6, and they're in color. Plus, if necessary, you can download a printable PDF from their website to print more if you have to.
Mm-hmm.
There's also four privacy screens for you to use to keep your maps secret.
Or change clothes.
Yes. I do think that the game handles differing numbers of players well, and it doesn't increase the game time. With two players, one player plays the intruders, and the other player plays the guards. With three, one player plays the ninja, and the second plays the traitor, which are the two intruders, while the third player plays the guards. And then finally, with four players, you split the guards in half for the last two players. And the guard minis come in two separate colors to make this easier. Setup does take a bit of effort, and the guard player has to place all of the guards in patrols or single sentry locations, and then mark his map with the locations of each of the mission objectives. So the game comes with six mission objectives, two traps, two hidden sentries, and eight sleeping guards that you have to mark on your hidden map. The intruder player will find these as they explore the map, attempting to complete their mission. In the beginning, they have to select one of these six missions randomly from these nice little cardboard pieces. Tiles. Yeah. There you go. And they range from like assassinating the Daimo to stealing war plans, things along that nature. And these are placed within the two houses or castles that are in the center of the board, randomly by the guard player. He just picks which one and marks it on his map. The intruder player also randomly puts their starting locations on their maps. They can pick wherever they want to come in at on the edge of the map board. And plus, they get to add in a secret passage, both ends of a secret passage, that they can connect any one location to another location on the map. Guard players can use it too, but they have to find it first. So far, I haven't been able to find it as playing the guard player, so...
You're just a lowly guard. You wouldn't know.
Exactly. Now then, all the players build a hand of cards from the ones available. The ninja player and the traitor player has a lot fewer cards to pick from, and the thing about using their cards is they don't get to reuse them. Once they've used a certain card, then that card's gone for the rest of the game. You have to use cards in order to kill various guards that have discovered you or other actions. Once you run out of cards that will kill somebody off that discovers you, your only option is really to run away.
Run away!
Ah! There's four phases to each turn. Most of them involve the guards. The guards get to change the alert level based on whether they discovered somebody or not. There's four different alert levels ranging from low to high. Basically, what this will do is the higher the alert level, the more cards that the guard player gets to draw at the beginning of their turn. Of course, there's a big difference because the guard player, one, starts with way more cards. If you're playing just one guard player, you get a starting hand of 24 cards to pick from. And then they can also reuse some of their cards.
Mm-hmm.
If the alert level's high enough, they get to redraw, shuffle in and redraw cards from the ones that they've discarded.
Yes.
The guards are placed on the board. Some are sentries, which are single guard posts around the board. And then some are placed in patrols, which is two guards that go along this track. It's marked on the board where this footpath that they can walk along goes. The second phase is the guard card phase, where the guard player can play up to two cards from their hand. Most of these cards involve listening or searching for the intruders. The only way for the patrols or the sentries to move from their positions that they're at on the board is by hearing an intruder or by finding one of them using one of these search cards. Basically, the guard player would play a listen card. The intruder player would have to reveal if the guard heard something based on how far they had moved that turn. So if an intruder, say the ninja, went three spaces during their turn, then they have to reveal if the particular guard you picked was within three spaces of the ninja. He has to tell you that, hey, you can hear me.
Oh, it was only a cat.
Yes, it was only a cat card. The third phase is the guard patrol phase. Each of your patrols moves two spots along the footpath around the board. And the final phase is the intruder phase. The intruders do their hidden movement on their maps, and they can move up to 3 spaces. Basically, 1 space is sneaking, 2 spaces is walking, and 3 spaces is running. They can search up to 2 locations that they move through, and the guard player has to tell them if there's anything located in each space. And of course, they're searching for their own specific objective in order to complete their mission. They can also find these hidden sentries, or they can find a trap, or they can find an objective that isn't theirs, but now at least they know where that objective is. And the 2 intruder players can cooperate between each other. They can say, hey, I'm doing objective A, and I'm doing objective C, so that if one of them finds one of the other, they can say, hey, go here. This is where it's at.
Because they're carrying walkie-talkies.
Exactly. Ancient Japanese walkie-talkies.
Ah, but it's not Japanese. It's Rokugan.
Rokugan?
It's Rokugan. So I guess it would be Rokugagian?
Rokugagian. I'm a Rokugagiist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The intruders now can also play cards, and many of these cards are used to kill guards that have discovered them or are in their way. One card can kill off a single guard. As you mentioned, the traitor player also has the It Was a Cat card, which allows them not to reveal their location if the guard happens to hear them. And once the cards are used, they're gone. So be careful.
You only have one cat.
That's right. Now, the secret passage helps the intruders a lot, as they can't be heard while they're in the secret passage, and it can take them directly in from the interior of one of the houses to the edge of the board near the wall. The intruder players do need to use a rope card in order to scale one of the walls, but the ropes stay in place and can be reused on their way back out. Play continues with searching, listening, moving, trying to find your objective, and moving until the intruder completes their objectives and escapes, or the guards catch him and kill him. The traitor player can take 2 wounds, and the ninja can take 3 before they're killed. Plus, the intruders can respawn if they're killed within the first 10 turns. The guard can wound an intruder if they find themselves in the same space, and the player has an attack card handy. Which, in most cases, you do, because you got 24 cards. Granted, I have to admit, I kept running out of my listen or search cards, and I wasn't drawing them. So it got a little difficult for me to, once I found the guy, to actually pin him down. And, you know, that kind of sucked.
You have an idea where the ninja is, but you can't
pin him down specifically. Right. And that's how, exactly. You know, most hidden movement games work. Me personally, I'm not a big fan of hidden movement games. This one does seem nicely thematic, and it is one of the better ones I've played. I'm not a big fan of Nuns on the Run or Scotland Yard. I really do like Fury of Dracula. I think that's my favorite of all.
Undead from Steve Jackson Games back in the early 80s. That was another hidden movement
with
Dracula. That was a pretty cool game.
Fury of Dracula. And I also like the fact that there are hidden objectives so that the intruders have to search to complete their mission. So it's not only the intruder players using the hidden map. It's the guard player, too. So it does make sense that all the players have their own little hidden maps. On the other hand, I prefer most of my action to take place actually on the board. The intruders have to keep looking between the board and their maps to see if they happen to cross the path of one of the guards. And you have to trust that they're keeping careful watch, as you can have up to 20 guards on the board at one time. So the guard player might get suspicious if the intruders are constantly able to evade them. And of course, as the guard
player... You're cheating!
I did get very suspicious. Plus, the intruders can get lucky, and one of them can finish their objective quickly and escape. Then they sit there and watch to see if the other intruder player can finish their goal and escape too before they know if they've won. Granted, the game takes less than an hour, so it isn't a major issue, but it can get boring for that particular player. So for this reason, I think the game hits its sweet spot with 2 players. It would be better for the intruders to have separate ways to win, or if they had to assist the other player with their objective before they could escape. It also seems more entertaining to be the intruders than the guards. I mean, once you find an intruder, they finally appear on the board with their figures. That is, until they kill off the guard that spotted them and run away. At which point they disappear again, and you have to start searching all over again. The intruders get to sneak around and do ninja stuff, you know, which is cool for them. And I think in most hidden movement games, it's a little more fun for the guy who's doing the hidden movement than it is for the guy who's looking for the dude. A couple of thoughts that I had is, you know, possibly the addition of a super guard who has their own special abilities and can move independently, can kill an intruder with 1 strike, would make it more entertaining for the guards. Then they could lower the number of guards on the board to balance it back out. one final thought. I think the privacy screen graphics should have been made to resemble those Japanese paper privacy screens rather than the like plain player symbols they came with.
Sure.
I think that would have helped to add to the thematics of the game. Overall, it's an okay game. It's got excellent components and it's got a great theme.
I would say, in my opinion, maybe I liked it a little bit more than you, but once again, I'm with you. I'm not a huge fan of hidden movement games. Like you were saying, Fury of Dracula, yeah, that's a cool game. I think we both agree we really like that game.
Yeah.
I haven't played Nuns on the Run. You're right. It seems like it's more fun to be the ninja than the guards because the guards do have some limitations. Well, they're just lowly guards. What can I tell you?
Yes.
But I agree with you as far as you have this really nicely done mounted board and really nice graphics and everything, and you hardly ever use it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost as if it's just a waste of resources there. It's a good game. If people enjoy the hidden movement style of games like Letters from Whitechapel and so forth, this is a very thematic game. They're going to enjoy it. They'll want to pick it up. If you're like us and, you know, you kind of like take it or leave it as far as hidden movement, you may want to think twice about getting it.
Yeah, I guess I'm in the minority because I've got Nuns on the Run and lots of people really love it. But, you know, it was just another hidden movement thing. And I'm like, yeah. And I hated Scotland Yard. We played like a couple of games. We took 20 minutes to set the thing up and get it all going.
And then you were done in five.
We were done in 5 minutes. And that's the big if for the hidden movement games is you can never really tell when the game is going
to
end.
Which for some people, that kind of leads to more tension. Other people, it's sort of like, are we going to wrap this up here or what?
Yeah.
So overall, I think we just aren't like giving a big thumbs up simply because we're not big fans of hidden movement games.
Right.
So my first game I'm going to tackle is going to be Sentinels of the Multiverse, which just came out at Gen Con. It's designed by Christopher Bedell and Paul Bender. It is for 2 to 5 players, or so they say. I'll have a little bit more about that in just a minute. And you should be able to play it within about 60 minutes, and it's suggested for ages 8 and up. As far as the review itself, I'm going to begin with some of the positives, and then I'm going to hunker down into reality because there are some major issues regarding this game and the gameplay. To begin with, I like the art in Sentinels and the Multiverse. It's fun. It's colorful. Kind of brings to mind the artwork you might find outside of the big two like Marvel and DC in the comic book world. It's not fabulous, but it's not horrible either. Yeah. My eyes didn't hurt.
It did give me reminiscences of like, I don't know, kind of Knights of the Dinner Table type artwork.
Oh gosh, not that. I wouldn't put it that far down the list, but.
Well, I kind of like that artwork. But
well, independent comics really is how I kind of look at it. You know, some of the smaller press comic companies out there where they don't have the big named artists and stuff. Yeah.
And I did like it. It's a good artwork. I like it.
Yeah, right. Each character card is presented as the cover of a comic.
Mm-hmm.
And the hit points are actually displayed as if it was the issue number for that character.
Mm-hmm.
Each character comes across with a little bit of personality as well, and you might be drawn into giving each of the 10 heroes that are included a run for their money just to see what each one of them brings to the table. In the game, you have 3 factors that are in play: heroes, villains, and environments. All in all, you end up breaking down the game to over 400 cards, and you have to divide these cards up into 18 decks. You'll have a deck for each character, good or evil, and the environments. So there's also 4 villains and 4 environments in which to do battle. That means there's a lot of possibilities, and these factors also give a really nice boost to the replayability. It's also important to point out the villain and hero cards are two-sided, and the villains have 2 distinct personalities, and you'll find that you're going to flip back and forth between these 2 states as the battle progresses. Those people out there who are comic book fans all know that any good baddie tends to have a few tricks up their sleeve when they find themselves up against the wall, and that's kind of a reflection with this two-sided villain card. As far as the heroes, their flip side represents their state once they're knocked out of action. This is a nice touch because in most co-op card games, and really most games overall, you simply find the ousted player gets the boot, and it leaves them kind of hanging around in the background waiting for a new game to begin. The environments are also a nice touch because they can be a boon or bane to the villain or heroes. They have different effects that affect each one differently. Each turn plays out in the same exact order. First, the villain begins by performing any effects on their card that take place at the start of the turn. Then they draw a new card from their deck, put that out, and finally, they end the turn with effects that take place at that point. Then each of the heroes will get to take their turns, and they play a card, use a power on their character card, and then draw a card from their own deck. Then, the last point is, the environment takes a turn, just as if they were the villain. So it plays out the same exact way.
Yeah.
And that's it. So it's pretty easy to teach. You can teach it quickly. It's not going to take very long for anybody to get the hang of it. And I'd say most first-time players, it might take 10 minutes to get them up to speed. Yeah. So far, it sounds like this is going to be a good game, doesn't it?
It does.
Sad to say, it's not. And the downsides of the game appear rather quickly, and there are a multitude of them. First off, Sentinels of the Multiverse has way too much record-keeping for a game of its type. Every time you turn around, you're going to find that you're adding and subtracting a multitude of modifiers based on the villain's effects, the villain's card in play, your hero, your hero's card in play, other hero's cards in play, the environment, and the environment's card in play. Okay, we're not talking about long division, but I was surprised to see so many cases of adding this, subtracting that.
Yeah.
Plus, you're always going to forget that there's some modifier out there, and you'll have, oh, wait, hang on, stop. Oh, I forgot. We got this. Okay, so the damage should really be this. It's not something you get used to. And to be honest, the more you play, the more irritating this becomes. It does. Tracking the hit points for each hero and villain is also a wee bit of a chore, since the total is constantly changing. So you better bust out some D20s to lend a hand. The game is supposed to be for 2 to 5 players, but it doesn't scale based on the number of players. If it's just you and a pal, you're going to get clobbered. If you max out with 5 players, you're going to sit back and enjoy a cakewalk. That is, unless you run across the dreaded screeching halt situation that I'm going to mention in a second. While I said the game is easy to learn, that does come back to bite the design, because the simplicity of it makes you feel like you don't have a whole lot to do. You're going to find that almost every turn, all you're going to do is you're going to look at the cards in your hand, you have 4, and try to figure out, okay, so which one of these cards is going to deal out the most damage?
Yeah.
It takes a few plays before this really starts to set in, but by the time you might break the game out for a 3rd or 4th time, you're going to find yourself just scanning your game collection to see what might be more engaging for all of your players as opposed to Sentinels of the Multiverse. Because like I said, it's not the first couple of times you play that you start to realize that your actions are really restricted, that you're really not doing anything. There's also 2 last issues that I want to address. Number 1, there are situations that can arise. Now, it's depending on the villain and the environment that you're taking on, because remember, everybody has their own little decks. You can have cards in play that reduce the players to nothing more than spectators. You can actually find the heroes in a spot where they can't use a power, they can't play cards, and they can't draw any cards. Those are the only things you do in a turn. So if you don't do any of those things, what's the point of playing? This is the screeching halt that I mentioned. And it's not something that's going to happen very often, but it does exist. And I do want to mention it, because the fact that this happened within the first 4 playthroughs was not a good thing.
Yeah.
Now, lastly, this isn't a huge issue for me, but I guarantee that Elliot could possibly be induced into having a stroke because of this.
I'm having one now. I'm having chest pains.
Call 911, call 911. The reason why you would have a stroke is the storage setup for the game, as in there isn't one.
Yes, yes, I noticed that.
You're going to have to divide the cards up into all these different decks, but there's absolutely no way for you to properly sort them due to the shallow depth of the box. You're left with either using rubber bands or baggies to sort the cards out, or just leaving them to intermix inside the box, waiting to be divvied up again the next time you play. Mm-hmm. If you're someone who really would dig a co-op superhero experience, you might want to give Sentinels of the Multiverse a try. For everyone else, myself included, I think taking a pass might be a better idea.
I think it bugs me the most that it doesn't scale very well. I mean, that's one thing that really has to be addressed in a game. If it's impossible with two players and too easy with five, well, you know, there's definitely flaws there.
And they tell you in the rules, these are the villains in the scale of difficulty. But even taking on the first villain just with two players, it's a whooping and not like you would like it to be. What's going on here?
That was fun.
I think the really big issue that I have is the fact that while playing it, we ran across, you know, and the thing is, I don't remember exactly what the environment was. The cards that were in play and the villain, you couldn't draw a card. Mm-hmm. You couldn't use a power. Or, well, you could use your, if I remember right, you could use the power, but it really had almost a minimal effect, and you couldn't play any cards. Yeah. So it was just sitting back while the heroes got hammered, and that was the end of it.
Nice.
Like I said, it's not something that would come up very often. In fact, probably just because of, you know, the luck of the draw, no pun intended, those cards were in play. But even the fact that that exists... And it wasn't like I had to play it 100 times for that really bugged me. To go off on a quick little tangent here, I think it's important that you and I play these games more than once or twice before we do reviews.
Yeah.
Because I guarantee there's probably people out there are going to be like, oh, yeah, hey, Sentinels of the Multiverse, great game, pick it up. Yeah, we played it one time. They're not going to tell you they played it one time. They're just going to go, yeah, good game. But the reality is, after multiple plays, there's just these little, you know, funky, wonky, fidgety things that start adding up to your irritation level. And then you can run into these situations where it's sort of like, well, okay, now we can't do anything. What's the point of playing this game?
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, that would bug me. Having to keep track of different modifiers on like 15 different cards in play constantly, a little too fiddly.
Right, because it's always changing because you'll have, okay, this is my hero, this is my card in play, okay, and then you'll forget, oh, so-and-so's hero here, that gave me a modifier, wait a second, hang on, so let me drop the hit points of the villain down. Come on, I could see if we were simulating the Eastern Front in World War I. Yeah, okay, maybe, yeah, I could think that we'll have to bust out the calculators once in a while. But I really did want to like this game. And in the end, after playing it a few times, I didn't. And I unfortunately think that the luster will really wear off on this game for people who pick it up very quickly.
Oh, you're always such Mr. Negative.
Yeah,
you're the Mr. Negative guy on the show.
There's been games that we've played and we've reviewed that if we wrote a review based on the first time we played it, we'd either be like, man, this game is great, or, well, this game is pretty terrible. And then it turns out, well, we had this rule wrong, or the strategy of the game starts to click. It's important that we do play through these a few times.
Oh, of course.
Because everybody else is out there spending $40 on a game where you've got spinning checkers. So I'm not going to let that go. And there are a lot of games out there that people will buy, and the first time they play it, they're like, yeah, this is a lot of fun. And then they play it a second time, and they're like, well, yeah, it's still fun. And then the third time, they're like, oh, man, we spent $65 on this game.
Right.
It's a public service. It's our public service announcement.
Provided to you, the gamer.
That's right. From us. With love.
With love. From the Gaming Gang. Now, the next game I'm going to talk about is Bloodsuckers from Fireside Games. That just recently came out. I can't remember whether it was Origins or Gen Con.
I think it was Gen Con.
Yeah, I think you're right. It was 2 to 4 players, ages 13 and up. Takes about an hour to play. So Bloodsuckers is their newest release from Fireside Games. They've also published Castle Panic.
Ah!
Ah! In essence, it's a card game that has many accoutrements enhance the experience and aid in the gameplay. Now, in Bloodsuckers, you play as either the vampires or the hunters and face off against each other in a series of battles. The player who wins the most battles wins the game. The components are top-notch. They've got full-color, glossy cards and rules, a stand-up board with all of the dials you need to track the progress of the game. They've got these little yellow crystals to mark your adrenaline tokens and these red glass beads for the blood tokens. And plus, they have player aid cards. I would have preferred a game board to the included player's mat, but I suspect that this is one of the reasons why the price point was really so reasonable for the game.
You had to play the game on your son, Matt?
Man, I'm slow. I'm so, like, what? What?
It's like long pause. Are you guys almost done? Because I got someplace I got to be.
The mat is nice, and since it's flat, you won't have cards laying at an angle on the edge of the board, which you would if it was an actual game board. So I do think it was the right choice to do a mat instead. Bloodsuckers is definitely one of the most unique game systems that I've played. The character cards are impressive, and they're multifunctional. Each card has two pictures on one side of the card that show each character as either a vampire or a hunter. You rotate it 180 degrees, depending on which one it is. Additionally, on the reverse side of the card is the bystander. Now, these bystander cards you play across the board when you go to a location, and the winner of that section of the battle will win that bystander card, who then becomes a new character in that player's force, either a hunter or a vampire.
And they're great with dip!
cheesy! Now, the bystander card also has a combat track on the back where each player puts their tokens to measure the force of their current battle over that particular bystander. I'll explain that better shortly, but I wanted to point out how many functions these cards serve without really being complicated in any way. One more note, each character has a special ability, which is also shown on the bystander side. So if you want to get characters with that specific ability, you can concentrate your forces on winning that particular bystander.
What are some of the special abilities they have? Good cook, excellent driver,
great hair.
Yes, because you know every vampire hunter has to have good hair.
That's right. Well, they have these like icons on the back, and on the front is, you know, the same icon, and the listing of what they all do is actually in the book. For example, if they've got the luck icon, then once each turn, one point can be added to any die roll for that character.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you have more than one character with this ability, one die roll can be modified for every character in play who has this ability. And this really does come in handy sometimes.
Okay.
Another one is, say, endurance. Once per turn, the player can re-roll a die and then keep the second result. And again, whoever has this ability can use it. And it's just got the icon on the bystander side, so you can really try to concentrate on getting, okay, I want all luck characters, or I want a combination of luck, endurance, rally, whatever character. So it just gives you a little incentive to go for particular bystanders.
Okay.
To start with, each player picks a side, which is, of course, either vampires or hunters. And the sweet spot for the game is two.
I want to be the mummies.
The mummy. The sweet spot is two players, followed by four, and then finally three. The three-player game has the most rule variation, so I don't recommend it for your first game. The game is fun regardless, and believe it or not, will take the same amount of time regardless of the number of players. That's one thing I really do look for in games, is for not huge increased amounts of time the more players that you add.
Well, it's about an hour with two players, and if you have three, it's 8 hours.
Cooperation between teammates is encouraged and essential. In a four-player game, each player will only get two turns to try to win a specific battle for their side. There's also rules for trading cards between teammates and specific combat cards that can benefit your teammate. So a four-player game can really become highly strategic. Everybody picks their initial characters by drawing them from the character deck and a hand of combat cards, tokens, and they get the player aid card. They decide how many locations that you're going to be fighting over in this game. Now, it comes with this stand-up board, and it's got like five dials on it. Mm-hmm. And each of these five dials represents a specific location, like the hospital or the police station.
Quickie Mart.
Who needs the Quickie Mart? So if you want to play a shorter game, you simply start with less locations. A full game is all five locations, and you're going to be having five separate battles.
Epic battle for the parking lot.
If you're in the mood for a shorter game, you just start with three.
Sure.
Now, on the stand-up board, you end up rotating the dial to the bystander position, and that shows you how many bystanders are actually in that location. So, for example, the police station has three bystanders according to the dial, and you draw three character cards and place them on the player mat in any of the bystander spots with that bystander side facing up. These represent the people that you're fighting over during the battle at, say, the police station.
Are all the characters unique?
Yes, all of the characters are unique.
There are no repeats of characters.
Correct. Granted, since they have a vampire side and a hunter side that she can flip around, I thought that this was really cool that they were able to combine so many different things into one silly card, and then you win that card, and then, hey, I got a new vampire, or hey, I got a new hunter.
Sure.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. The time dial actually tells you which player's turn it is based on its current setting. During a turn, a player will first perform three actions, which can be playing a combat card, drawing a new combat card, moving characters to different sections, playing a blood or adrenaline token, and so on. You can even bank up to two actions for use later in the game, so you can save up and, at a crucial point, use these extra actions that you have saved, and it can really make a difference in winning a particular battle.
I've got a little extra whooping I've been holding back. It's my last can of whoop ass.
By Ronco. Playing combat cards is the crux of the game. When you play a combat card, you're having one of your characters launch an attack. So if I play a machine gun on Jennifer, she's launching an attack with a strength of 4. I place a token on the track on the bystander card in her location on the number 4. The next player decides to launch an attack in the same section and plays a gouge combat card, because, you know, those vampires, they gouge. That has a strength of 5.
So gouging somebody is more powerful than opening up with a machine gun?
Yes, but only if it's nighttime.
Gotcha.
When the vampires are at their highest power. If it's daytime, it's worth a lot less, which is another little neat feature, because it's daytime or nighttime, depending on where you are on the time dial.
Right.
Then so they place their token on the same bystander on the number 5. So they are now winning the battle for that particular bystander because they're higher on the track. But the attacks aren't cumulative. If I launch another attack on the same bystander on my next turn using, say, a Molotov cocktail that has a strength of 2, my token moves down to the 2 spot on the track. Now, the Molotov cocktail has the added power to reduce an opponent's attack to 0, so I would take their attack, which was on 5, and move that all the way down to 0. So now I would again be winning, and the score is 2-0. There's different combat decks for each team, so the hunters won't be biting people and the vampires won't be using shotguns.
Ah, rats.
It is possible for a vampire to turn a hunter into one of the undead and thus join their side. But the hunters do counter this by being able to stake a nasty vamp on occasion. After taking your actions, you can discard and draw new combat cards up to your max hand size, and then you can untap any of your characters that were stunned. A stunned character can't perform any actions, and you show this by tapping them, basically, or rotating them 90 degrees. And finally, on your turn, you rotate the time dial one section over, and it's the next player's turn. And once the time dial has made a complete revolution over the 8 spots on it, the battle's over. Each player looks at the locations of their tokens on the back of the bystander cards, and the player with the highest attack total on each card wins that card. And that bystander joins their side as a character. Ties, neither one of them wins, and the bystander just, you know, wanders off.
I don't know what all the fuss was about.
Okay, I don't know which way. The team that wins the most bystander cards in that battle wins that location and rotates the dial on the stand-up thing to either the vampire symbol or the hunter symbol to show which player controls that particular location. In the event of a tie, the location becomes locked and no one is in control. Next, the team that controls the fewest locations gets to select the next location where you're going to have a battle. And it goes all over again.
So if I may ask, you won't fight for the same location a second time?
That is correct. Once you've settled one location, it's done. Now, whichever team wins the most locations wins the game. If they're tied, then the team that has the most characters wins the game. If they're still tied, you go into this sudden death round to determine the winner, which is basically one more battle over another location, and poof, whoever wins that wins.
How do you knock characters out of the game?
There are cards that allow you to actually kill, say, a vampire,
eliminate a hunter.
Bite a hunter, and then turn them into vampires as well.
Okay.
So characters can move back and forth or be discarded.
Okay.
There's not a lot of those cards. There's only a few. So really the only way to get new characters is by winning a new bystander.
Right.
And at the beginning of each battle, you get to pick which characters you're going to be playing with during that battle. It can happen that you're down to like two characters and like, oh, okay, well, I guess I hope I win.
Mm-hmm.
But it really kind of adds to the strategy of the game because you really want to concentrate on winning a particular bystander. Even if you can't win the whole battle, at least you can get more, one or two more character cards over to your side, which will mm-hmm. definitely help you in the next battle.
Sure.
So there's a lot of little strategy built in there, which is more apparent the more you play it. Now, my mistake, of course, was playing a three-player game first. And when the dial got to player two for the hunters, I didn't know whether or not I was supposed to take all of the hunters' turns or just skip the sections on the dial that shows hunter player two's turn. Because that's what the dial will show. It's like hunter player one, vampire mm-hmm. player one, things like that.
Okay.
It wasn't really made clear in the rules, so I opted for taking all of the hunters' turns on the dial, as it made the most sense. The vampire players get a total of four turns during the battle, so it made sense that I would too. Also, if you're playing a three-battle game and lose the first two battles, then there's no point in playing the third battle because the game's already lost.
Right.
It's the same with the five battles if you lose the first three.
Mm-hmm.
The rules don't really say anything about this, but we would just end the game and start a new one, basically, if this happened. The game can lead to some analysis paralysis, especially when you realize that this is your last turn during the current battle, and you need to plan out exactly how to put yourself in the best position to win the most bystander cards.
What do I do?
The game is quick enough, though, that this really isn't that big of a problem. This is where the strategy comes in, and a well-played turn can really pay off. This is a game that you really need to play to get a feel for it. It's different, and it's a lot of fun. After multiple plays, I'm still trying out different strategies, which really do change depending on the number of players. It's thematic, it's challenging, and I really liked it a lot.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a good game.
Very cool. So it sounds like it really is kind of a different game. It's not just a rehash of the same old, same old.
No, it's not, and that's one of the things I liked about it. I thought it was kind of a unique system.
I do have one last question, though.
Uh-huh.
Can you have your characters go over or under other characters?
No, but you can play with the little adrenaline tokens or blood tokens.
And spin them like a top?
Spin them like a top, yes.
Nice.
So that is a little bonus there for you.
Excellent. Well, my final review is going to be Hero of Weehawken from Victory Point Games. Those of you who had listened to the first Gaming Gang Extra, it was all about Victory Point Games. There was this underlying kind of running gag about Hero of Weehawken. There was a lot of talk about it, and everybody I interviewed, all except I think one person, mentioned Hero of Weehawken.
Waukegan?
Yeah, Waukegan. It's not out yet. My understanding is it will release from Victory Point Games, I want to say September 8th. So the first couple of weeks of September, it should be out. It's designed by Robert Leonard, and it is a solitaire game. It's recommended for ages 12 and up. Honestly, you should be able to play through it within about 45 minutes or so. I don't think it would take much longer than that.
Yeah.
I have to point out that this game is going to be the definitive Aaron Burr conspiracy game you will ever play.
So leave out all the others?
Don't even think about picking up any other Aaron Burr-based game. Don't. I know there's a multitude of them out on the market. Don't even bother
all
taking
them. Right, hold on. I'm removing them from my wish list right now.
There you go. Yeah, take them right off. Go over to Board Game Geek. Just remove them. Of course, I'm kidding. This game is actually based on a rather obscure time in history. I'll be the first to point out, the only thing I remember about Aaron Burr was he killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the Got Milk commercial where it's the guy who, I think he's either like a fanatic about Alexander Hamilton or Aaron Burr, one of the two. I mean, he's got the pistols that were used in the duel, and he's got the bullet, and he's listening to the radio, and they ask, who killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel? And they call him up, and he's eating like a peanut butter sandwich. And he can't, you know, he's like, Aaron Burr, Aaron Burr. And they're like, what? What? Aaron Burr. So, because he didn't have milk, he didn't win the big prize, whatever. Right. What actually happened historically, Aaron Burr was the vice president under Thomas Jefferson during his first term. And back in the day, back in that point in U.S. history, the vice president was actually the person who came in second place in the presidential race. Mm-hmm. So you would actually have people who could not work together, who couldn't stand each other as president and vice president. You don't see so much of that anymore, because there was an amendment that was passed by Jefferson, which allowed the ticket to be formed. So you'd be voting for the president and vice president. What happens is, historically, Burr ends up basically getting the boot, and he's no longer vice president. The reason why the duel took place is Burr was running for governor of New York, and Hamilton was running a smear campaign against him, saying some pretty nasty things about Burr, and Burr took exception. So what ends up happening is Burr leaves the political life. He sets off and he says he's going to retire and settle this area of the U.S. and he's going to call it Burrsylvania. Burrsylvania. Where are you from? Burrsylvania? Oh, nice area. He's always like maneuvering behind the scenes. Jefferson's still president. He doesn't know what Burr is up to. Is Burr going to actually settle down? Is he going out west to try to put together an invasion of Mexico? Is he looking to annex the western part of the United States? It's not part of the U.S. yet. Mm-hmm. Is he going to try to raise insurrection against the government in New Orleans, or is he going to try a coup d'etat and overthrow the government already in place? These were a lot of things that were floating around, and Jefferson was very, very concerned. Burr was also working with one of the generals in charge of the army. So the game itself, you take on the role of Thomas Jefferson. You actually are trying to further your own agendas as the president, while at the same time looking to not only stop whatever nefarious plans Burr may have, or he may legitimately be planning on settling down. So you not only have to stop that, you have to figure out what is he up to. You have three different maps, really. One map is your main area map, where you'll have various different tracks to track your political influence. It also tracks your three agendas. One agenda that you have is to create a Virginia dynasty. Most people probably realize that out of the first, 15 presidents of the United States, a great majority of them did come from Virginia. You also have an agenda where you're trying to change over the Supreme Court to better reflect your views. And also you're kind of going back and forth with England, because Jefferson had very little time for the British. So you're trying to manipulate them as well. You have an area of the West where you have conspirators who are working with Burr, as well as Burr himself, are placed face down. You'll actually use federal agents to try to root out these conspirators. There's also a track, once Burr is located, he's making his way to New Orleans, and that's probably where the conspiracy, his plan, is going to launch from. You also have a map, or I should say like a play mat, which will track the actual conspiracy, and you have different cards that will speed up the process of that launching and also be adding to its likelihood of success. Then finally, you have the trial. Because historically, Jefferson had Burr arrested and he had him charged with treason, and Burr did go to trial. I won't give you any spoilers. You can go to Wikipedia if you'd like to find out what happened.
Hey, that would require reading.
You have the internets. Go check it out. It's actually very, very interesting. So the game kind of breaks down almost into two mini games. The first, you'll have a deck of cards, and I will be the first one to point out, if there is any game from Victory Point Games that demands that you sleeve your cards, Hero of Weehawken is it. Elliot, I know you had an issue when you did your review of I Say Holmes, mm-hmm. that you had to reshuffle all the time,
right.
And because of the size of the cards and just the way they're cut, made it very difficult to continually be reshuffling.
Yep.
You'll be doing that with this game as well. with these cards, you have 9 conspiracy cards or conspirator cards, of which many of them are one individual, James Wilkinson, who is in charge of the U.S. Army. And you have other conspirators who may or may not have been assisting Burr in whatever plans he actually had. No one knows for sure, historically, what he really was up to.
Yeah.
I'll finish up the review and tell you what most historians think. So you take these 9 conspiracy cards and you shuffle them up, and then you secretly take 3 of the cards and you put them to the side. Those are going to be your conspirators. The rest of those cards are shuffled into the main deck, and the main deck has various different events, and it has evidence which is going to be used in the trial. You'll have presidential prestige points. Each turn, you'll flip a card. And like most of the victory point games that do utilize various cards, you'll have a specific order that you'll look at the card and those things take place. So you could gain additional presidential power or influence that you can use. It could be an event where if you spend influence, you can keep that card for later use. It could be a piece of evidence both in favor of or against Aaron Burr once you've captured him and put him on trial, and so forth. There are a lot of different ways that you can go about playing the game, because to start off with, you don't really know what Burr is up to. You don't know who his conspirators may be. You can actually go about running the government and trying to advance your agendas. If you complete the track for the Virginia Dynasty, you'll automatically receive an additional point of political influence per full turn. And I'll mention what that is in just a sec. If you complete the changeover of the Supreme Court, you get an additional modifier to your roles during the trial. And if you manipulate the British and blockade them effectively and embargo British goods, at the end of the game, your level of victory will increase.
So it's up to you to just decide which one you want to concentrate, which objectives you want to concentrate on during the game?
Correct.
Okay.
And because you have these political influence points, you can use them to roll to try to increase the track, to move them along on the track. And of course, as you move closer and closer to completing that agenda, it becomes harder and need a 5 or a 6 on a 6-sided die and so forth. You also, as you're going through these cards, you're going to run across these evidence cards. Now, you'll have evidence cards where they're in favor of Burr. You can actually pay to take that card and put it back in the deck and reshuffle it.
Really?
Yes.
Got our own conspiracy going on there.
Correct. You also have cards where you'll flip them over, and it may be a piece of evidence that you can use against Burr. You'll use your political influence to purchase that. It may be a conspirator card, which you'll receive political influence for revealing that conspirator, and that goes off to the side. It's sort of along the lines of when you're figuring out what exactly is going on, a little bit along the lines of Clue.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You get to discover the 3 conspirators that aren't there.
Exactly. Keep in mind, you would have to get all 6 conspirator cards before you're able to make that exact conclusion. Mm-hmm. Many times when you're playing, you're not going to be able to get to that point because while you're going through the deck, you're running across cards that are going to continue to move Burr's conspiracy along to actually launching.
Mm-hmm.
When you start getting to the point where, this is kind of worrying, something's up here, you can use federal agents to go out west to try to apprehend the conspirators. You'll use political influence points to take your agent, move them out west, reveal one of the counters, and then you'll also spend political influence later to arrest them and bring them back east.
Mm-hmm.
You can have Burr, you can find Burr, and he will move to this western track, which is basically moving along down to New Orleans. And as he moves along, you roll to see if his plan is hatched, if it's put into effect. So you can't just sit back and run the country and be going through the deck, because if the conspiracy does launch, you don't know what it might be, but you're going to lose victory points regardless.
Right.
Because you didn't stop it, even if he's planning on just simply retiring to the good life in Brazilvania.
We must stop him.
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of decisions that have to be made. It moves really quickly. You'll sit there and you'll say, okay, well, because when you reveal many of these cards that will advance the conspiracy, you can once again pay these political influence points to put that back into the deck. But the problem is, if you continue to do that, you are not going to have any political influence to do anything else.
Yeah.
And as you're pulling out cards that are beneficial for you, all that means is you're going to be left with a lot of cards in the deck that are going to be beneficial to Burr. So you don't want to be caught in a situation where you have no political influence points and you're flipping these cards up that are evidence in favor of him, or it's helping him launch his plan, simply because you won't be able to stop them. Now, some of the cards are events, and you'll flip that card over. It's going to tell you what it is, and you may have to roll a die for something. It'll give you different results. And then your turn ends. You don't get to roll to advance your political agenda. If you've got your Virginia dynasty established, you're not going to get that additional political influence point. So it is kind of, you have to kind of sit there and wonder, well, okay, what do I do this turn? It's not a game that you're just going to fly through. Once you've apprehended Burr and you're going to try him, you have to deduce what are the charges that you're going to charge him with. Is it treason? Is he trying to overthrow the government? Is he looking to start a war with Spain? Because effectively, invading Mexico is invading Spain, and so forth. And you'll use the conspirator cards that you've revealed to try to make that decision. Once you get to the trial, now you break out the second game, which is kind of a mini game, and you'll make arguments. So you roll two dice. One die is for the defense. One die is for the prosecution. If the prosecution is a higher roll, the defense will get to play an evidence card to try to beat your roll. You can play an evidence card in return to try to further your argument. If you've completed the judicial agenda, you get a +1 modifier to the roll right off the bat. You need to have evidence that you've built up to be able to play, because once you fail to beat the defense roll, the trial is over. And you have a track that you'll actually move along on the trial. Effectively, there are a lot of different things that can happen. You can completely screw the pooch and charge him with something that he was not doing. Say, for an example, oh, he was trying to foment a coup d'etat and he was really going to retire to Brussels. Oops.
Sorry.
And we've now hung an innocent man. If you actually go through the entire trial to completion and the charge is strong enough, Burr and his co-conspirators that you've captured will be hung. They will be executed.
And he deserved it.
Then again, maybe he's acquitted because they had better evidence cards than what you had collected. And it turns out that, guess what? He was going to annex the western part of the United States and create his own empire. It's a really fun game. It's an interesting game. There are a few little fidgety things. I have to say that I think out of all the Victory Point games I've played, I had to refer to the rule book much more than I had ever had before. Also, the way the main play map is set up, there's the Western section, and it has a breakdown. You know, most of the Victory Point games on the maps, they've got a lot of, you know, helpful little information areas that tell you different things, so you don't have to go look at the rule book continuously. Right. The problem is, the box for the West has all the information as far as revealing conspirators, arresting conspirators, but that's where you put the counters upside down. So all that information is covered up by the counters.
Okay.
That kind of defeated the purpose of actually having that information in that box. I wouldn't say that this is up there in the realm of Dawn of the Zeds or We Must Tell the Emperor or Zulus on the Ramparts, things like that. You know, some of what I think are the shining examples of VPG games, but it is definitely worth a buy.
It actually sounds pretty interesting, I gotta say.
It is. It is very interesting. It's got a lot of replayability because there's so many different factors that can change,
yeah,
you know, who the conspirators are, you know, the different events that come up. I did have an issue where every time I turned around, I seemed to be shuffling the deck again. I did sleeve the cards to start off with, so it wasn't that big of a hassle.
Yeah.
No, so I didn't have the issue where it was tough to shuffle the little cards together. A lot of fun. Definitely, I would recommend picking it up, especially if you enjoy a good solitaire game and you want to learn more about a time in history, an event in history that is very, very obscure and many people don't know about it.
Really, I don't know about that. I knew what you mentioned that most people know is that you shot Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah, I didn't even know why. I had no idea. I figured, it's over a woman or something. You know, who knows? But I did promise that I would tell you what historians think Burr was actually up to.
Uh-huh. You did?
I lied. I'm not going to. No, I'm kidding. Actually, Aaron Burr is one of the founding fathers that you don't hear a whole lot about, although he was very influential. He was actually a hero of the Revolutionary War as well. The problem that most historians have had with Burr was he wasn't one of these kind of self-sacrificing, all for the good of the nation kind of guys. Hamilton was along the same lines, and that's why Alexander Hamilton's not exactly well represented either. But supposedly, Burr was actually a pretty decent guy. He just kind of tended to put himself ahead of the country, which nowadays wouldn't be anything odd at all. There is absolutely, from what they could tell, there is no evidence that Aaron Burr had anything up his sleeve other than he was planning on retiring from political life. He had a lot of different connections. Actually, the person who sold him out, James Wilkerson, was the person who was in charge of the U.S. Army, was actually in the employ of the Spanish. So he was funneling all the information he had about the U.S. Army to the Spaniards. And supposedly, he was conspiring with Burr and then turned traitor on Burr and revealed to Jefferson that Burr was planning effectively a coup d'etat. But the only piece of evidence that Wilkerson had was a letter that was written in his own handwriting that he said was actually a copy he had made of Burr's letter to him.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, Wilkerson's pretty interesting in the game as well, because he can be very helpful for you, and he can also be devastatingly bad for you. It really depends on how many conspiracy cards you reveal that have his name on it. So there you have it. Hero of Weehawken.
Very good.
I believe that pretty much brings to a close this episode. What I wanted to do as we finish up from here on out on shows is just kind of let people know what some of the games are that we're going to be reviewing in the very near future. Because I think a lot of times everybody's kind of left hanging of, what are they going to tackle next time around?
Okay.
Just want to say on the website and probably on the show, we're going to see some reviews of the GMT titles that I had mentioned before, Son of York. God, now I can't remember the Japanese unification game off the top of my head. No Retreat, Space Empires 4X. I have the Monster Field Commander Napoleon from Dan Versen Games. It is huge. That's going to be coming very soon. We've got some role-playing games to be reviewed as well. Elliot, what are you bouncing around?
There's the Traveler RPG along with Steampunk, the RPG from Uber Goober Games. Got a couple of Rio Grande titles that we're going to be going over, including, say, Black Friday, Asteroids, a few others. Loch Ness. There's Sync Up from
Sync Up,
which is a game by the makers of Telestrations, USAopoly.
Or USAopoly. Yeah. Cool. So we got loads and loads of stuff coming.
Yep, it's true.
Anything else that you would like to add?
Kids, don't drink and drive.
I would hope kids don't drive, period.
If you are going to drive, don't drink.
And if you are going to drink, don't drive.
Nope, that's all I got.
All I want to say is happy birthday to the Gaming Gang. We will have celebrated our first anniversary by the time our next show comes up. So let's hope for another pretty strong year. It's been a pretty wild run.
It has been.
So
it's been pretty cool.
All right. Well, Elliot, take us out.
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard, or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek, or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of reviewed copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.